when we hosted a drag show for the Feast of the Epiphany in January, we partnered with Pierrot's nephew, Diego, and some of his friends from the Bushwick drag scene. We planned for it to be a fundraiser for a new social justice partner, the Anti-Violence Project. When Liz Edmond, who is on the board of the Anti-Violence Project, told them we were doing this and doing it as a fundraiser for them, their response was to ask us if we had security for the event and to offer that if anything traumatizing happened, they were here to support us. Fortunately, nothing happened. It was a beautiful, joyful night retelling the story of the Magi and the Holy Family avoiding the murderous King Herod. Today is the Feast of the Transfiguration, the hinge between the Advent, Christmas, Epiphany cycle and the Lent, Easter cycle in the church year. Lent begins with Ash Wednesday, this coming Wednesday. And again, like last year, we're hosting a queer glitter and ash service with Billy McEntee preaching. I'm conscious that doing such an overtly queer-affirming event could make St. Lydia's a target. If the church were in another state, say Arkansas or Texas, or another of the 12 states currently working on drag bans, holding such a service might even be illegal. Many of these anti-drag laws come on the heels of copycat anti-transgender and abortion ban bills. In fact, if you map the states where these various bills are happening, it's all the same states. After the Obergefell decision on marriage equality in 2015 and the Bostock decision in 2020 on employee protection from discrimination for LGBTQ persons, conservative activists, including the Heritage Foundation and the Alliance Defending Freedom, founded a new organization called Promise to America's Children. Rather than protecting children, however, they are brazenly seeking to legislate their ideology, causing despair and harm to the very people they claim to protect. One activist and drag performer who rallied on Trans Day of Visibility at the Arizona Capitol said, "It's disheartening because it's just telling the public that drag is dangerous, and I don't want another shooting. It's just art. It's just self-expression. It's just love." And in a moving article in this morning's New York Times focused on the situation in Missouri, a parent of a trans child expressed the anguish of such laws. "It's like trying to legislate into law that my kid is not normal and should not exist." Yet in fact, these laws are driven by very few wealthy donors, and they play to the extremes of American society. Nonpartisan public religion research institutes' recent poll showed nearly 8 in 10 Americans back non-discrimination protection for LGBTQ persons, including 65% of Republicans. A full 2/3 of Americans oppose bills limiting the rights of transgender people. While the broad swath of the public does not support these regressive laws, one demographic staunchly maintains support for discrimination: white evangelical Christians. White Christian America has become, as a demographic, a minority population. That happened in about 2015, which is a first in our history as a nation. And white evangelicals are shrinking even more, now just 14% of the population, down from 20% a decade ago. This leads me back to Scripture and to this day in the church year, the Feast of the Transfiguration. Its very character, a story of Jesus' body being changed — in Greek, the word is metamorphosis — lends itself to our reflection on the experiences of fluidity and identity in human life. Yet there's more. Matthew takes the story of the Transfiguration from Mark's gospel, but shifts it ever so slightly. Of course, the way to experience, he notes the ways the experience echo Moses on Mount Sinai. Those remain in Matthew's version. God's appearance in the cloud, the shining face of Moses when he descended from the mountain, and as in Mark, the voice claims Jesus as beloved. Yet Matthew shifts the scene away from the Moses story, introducing echoes of an apocalyptic vision drawn from the book of Daniel. You may recall Daniel, that brave soul living in exile in Babylon, who breaks the law by praying to God morning, noon, and night, and then is thrown into the lion's den. Daniel's later chapters contain visions of the sort that resemble the book of Revelation. These books are often called apocalyptic literature. The Greek word apokleptein literally means to uncover, to show what is and is to be. I was reading Jack's book, Hands of Doom, on this very topic, where he describes Black Sabbath's use of this subversive genre of apocalyptic literature in just the ways the book of Daniel and Revelation do in the Bible, using coded language and imagery to claim that the powers of violence and harm will not prevail. In Daniel chapter 8, Daniel sees a wild vision of horned animals fighting for dominance, and in the end, Daniel falls to the ground frightened. Then one who appears as human comes to Daniel and touches him and lifts him up to his feet. This human one then helps Daniel to understand the vision. Matthew takes this scene directly, addressing the disciples like Daniel falling to the ground, confused and afraid, and the human one, Jesus, touching them and saying, "Get up and do not be afraid." Then he tells them to tell no one about the vision on the mountaintop until the human one has been raised from the dead. This vision, this transfiguration, this apocalyptic scene Matthew sketches here is directed at the suffering people in his community. In connecting this mountaintop vision to the resurrection, the ultimate metamorphosis from death to life, Jesus claims that those who stand for violence and harm will not prevail. They may shout loudly and marshal every weapon in their arsenal, yet their strategy of demonizing and oppressing others will fail, exactly because those are the very ones whom God calls beloved. As our closing hymn proclaims today, God calls you good, beloved child. Yet in the meantime, some of our beloveds are at risk. And here is where a community called Beloved has work to do. Next month, with some funding from a grant St. Lydia's got from the Wild Gifting Project for developing our identity as a queer church, Liz Edmond and I and LGBTQ activists from around the country are gathering for an upstander training. This training is provided by the Anti-Violence Project, and it's intended to equip congregations to be more effective allies in the face of spiritual and physical violence against queer folks. An upstander, as opposed to a bystander, is a person who speaks or acts in support of an individual or cause, particularly someone who intervenes on behalf of a person being attacked or bullied. It is, if you will, apocalyptic action, rooted in the vision we claim at the heart of our faith. God calls you good, beloved child, and we will not stand by when you are told otherwise. We share the sermon at St. Lydia's, and we'll hold a moment of silence, and then when I ring the bell, you're invited to share your stories or experiences sparked by the scripture or by my reflections. We don't engage in opinions or crosstalk at St. Lydia's, but rather share our own stories so that we can do what Jesus did, telling stories, and thereby get to know one another more deeply. We begin in silence.